I thought that while I was waiting for the refrigerator truck to be repaired, I might as well go down to the waterhole at Fig Tree Pan. Ambassador Ning's voice interrupted Johnny Inzu's concentration, but he felt no resentment as he looked up from his desk. In Johnny's view, one of his major duties was to make the wilderness accessible to anybody who had an interest in nature. Ning Cheng Gong was certainly one of those. Johnny smiled at his accoutrement, the field guide and the binoculars. He rose from his desk, glad of the excuse to escape from the drudgery of paperwork, and went with the ambassador out onto the veranda and down to his parked Mercedes, where he stood and chatted to him for a few minutes, making suggestions as to where he might get a glimpse of the elusive and aptly named gorgeous bushshrike that Cheng wanted to observe. When Cheng drove away, Johnny walked down to the vehicle workshops where Ranger Gomo was stripping and reassembling the alternator of the unserviceable truck. He was dubious about Gomo's ability to effect the repair. In the morning, he would probably have to ring the warden at Mana Pools and ask him to send a mechanic to do the job. One consolation was that the elephant meat would keep indefinitely in the cold storage of the hull. The truck's refrigerating equipment was plugged in now to the camp generator, and the thermometer registered 20 degrees below freezing when Johnny checked it. The meat would be processed and turned into animal feed by a private contractor in Harare. Johnny left Ranger Gomo to his labour over the dismembered alternator and went back to his office under the acacia trees. No sooner had he left the workshop than Gomo looked up and exchanged a significant glance with David, the other Black Ranger. The alternator he was tinkering with was a worn-out piece of equipment that he had retrieved from the scrap heap in Harare for just this purpose. The truck's original alternator, in perfect working order, was hidden under the driver's seat in the cab. It would take less than 10 minutes to bolt it back in place and reconnect the wiring. Back in his office, Johnny settled to the monotony of his forms and ledgers. Once he glanced at his wristwatch and found that it was a few minutes before 1 o'clock. But he wanted to finish the week's reports before knocking off for lunch. Of course, it was a temptation to go up to the house early. He liked to be with the children for a while before lunch, especially with his son. But he resisted the impulse and worked on conscientiously. Anyway, he knew that Mavis would probably send the children down to fetch him soon. She liked to serve his lunch promptly. He smiled in anticipation of their arrival as he heard a sound at the door and looked up. The smile faded. A stranger stood in the doorway, a stocky man with bow legs, dressed in filthy rags. Both his hands were behind his back, as though he was concealing something. "Yes?" Johnny asked shortly. "Who are you? What do you want?" The man smiled. His skin was very dark, with purple-black highlights. When he smiled, the scar that ran down one cheek pulled his mouth out of shape, and the smile was malicious and humorless. Johnny stood up from the desk and went towards him. "What do you want?" he repeated, and the man in the doorway said, "You!" From behind his back he brought out an AK-47 rifle and lifted the barrel towards Johnny's belly. Johnny was caught totally off guard in the centre of the room. However, his recovery was almost instantaneous. His reflexes were those of a hunter and a soldier. The armoury door was 10 paces to his left, and he went for it. The park's weapons were kept in there. Through the door he could see the rack of firearms on the far wall. With despair turning his legs as heavy as concrete, Johnny realized that none of the weapons in the rack was loaded. That was his own strict safety rule. The ammunition was kept in the locked steel cupboard under the gun rack. All this passed through his mind as he leapt for the door. From the corner of his eye he saw the scar-faced brigand swing the AK-47 onto him, and halfway across the room Johnny tumbled forward like an acrobat, ducking under the blast of automatic fire that swept across the room. As he rolled smoothly to his feet, he heard the man curse, and Johnny dived forward once more for the doorway. He realized that his assailant was good. He had seen that he was a killer in the practiced way he handled the rifle. It was a miracle that he had been able to evade the first close-range volley. The air was filled with a haze of plaster dust that the bullets had battered from the wall, and Johnny dived through it, but he knew he was not going to make it. The man with the AK-47 was too good. He could not be fooled again. The shelter of the doorway was too far for Johnny to reach before the next burst came. The clock in Johnny's head was running. He anticipated how long it would take for the man to recover his balance. The muzzle of the AK-47 always rode up uncontrollably in automatic fire. It would take him the major part of a second to bring it down, in line-up for the second burst. Johnny judged it finely and twisted his body violently aside, but he was a fraction late. The gunman aimed low to compensate for the rise of the AK. One bullet sliced through the flesh of Johnny's thigh, missing the bone, but the second cut through the lower curve of his buttock and smashed into the joint at the femur, shattering the head and the cup of bone of the pelvis. The other three bullets of the burst flew wide as Johnny threw himself to one side. However, his left leg was gone, and he fell against the door jamb and tried to hold himself from falling. His impetus sent him sliding sideways along the wall, and his fingernails screeched as they gouged the plaster. He ended up facing back into the room, standing on one leg. His left leg hung from the shattered joint, and his arms were flung open like a crucifix as he tried to hold his balance. Still smiling, the gunman clicked the rate of fire selector onto single shot. He wanted to conserve ammunition. A single round cost him 10 Zambian kwacha and had to be carried hundreds of miles in his pack. Each cartridge was precious, and the warden was maimed and completely at his mercy. One more bullet would be enough. "Now," he said softly, "now you die." And he shot Johnny Inzu in the stomach. The bullet drove the breath from Johnny's lungs with an explosive exhalation. He was slammed hard against the wall and doubled over by the brutal force of the impact, and then he toppled forward. Johnny had been hit before during the war, but he had never received a full body strike, and the shock of it was beyond his worst expectations. He was numbed from the waist down, but his brain stayed clear, crystalline, as though the rush of adrenaline into his bloodstream had sharpened his perception to its limits. "Play dead," he thought, even as he was going down. His lower body was paralysed, but he forced his torso to relax. He hit the floor with the loose, unresisting weight of a flour sack, and did not move again. His head was twisted to one side, his cheek pressed to the cold cement floor. He lay still. He heard the gunman cross the floor, the rubber soles of the combat boots squeaking softly. Then his boots entered Johnny's field of vision. They were dusty and worn almost through the uppers. He wore no socks, and the stink of his feet was rancid and sour as he stood within inches of Johnny's face. Johnny heard the metallic snick of the mechanism as the Zambian moved the rate of fire selector again, and then felt the cold, hard touch of the muzzle against his temple as the man lined up for the coup de grace. "Don't move," Johnny steeled himself. It was his last despairing hope. He knew that the slightest movement must trigger the shot. He had to convince the gunman he was dead. At that moment there was a burst of shouting from outside the room, and then a volley of automatic fire, followed by more shouting. The pressure of the rifle muzzle was lifted from Johnny's temple. The stinking boots turned away and retreated across the floor towards the doorway. "Hey, come on, don't waste time," the scar-faced gunman yelled through the open door. Johnny knew enough of the northern Chinyangja dialect to understand. "Where are the trucks? We must get the ivory loaded." The Zambian ran out of the office, leaving Johnny lying alone on the cement floor. Johnny knew that he was mortally hit. He could feel the arterial blood squirting out of the wound in his groin, and he rolled on his side and swiftly loosened the top of his trousers. Immediately he smelled his own feces and knew that the second bullet had ripped open his intestines. He reached down into his crotch and pressed his fingers into the wound in his groin. Blood spurted hotly over his hand. He found the open artery and pinched off the end of the severed femoral. Mavis and the babies, that was his next thought. What could he do for them? At that moment he heard more firing from up the hill, in the direction of the domestic compound and his own cottage. "It's a gang of them," he realised with despair. "They're all over the camp. They're attacking the compound. And then my babies. Oh, God, my babies!" He thought about the weapons in the room next door. But he knew he could not get that far. Even if he did, how could he handle a rifle with half his guts shot away and his lifeblood spreading in a pool under him? He heard the trucks. He recognised the beat of the big diesels and knew that they were the refrigerator trucks. He felt a surge of hope. "Gomo," he thought. "David?" But it was short-lived. Lying on his side, clinging to his severed artery, he looked across the room and realised that he could see through the open door. One of the white refrigerator trucks pulled into his view. It reversed up against the door of the ivory godown. As soon as it parked, Gomo jumped out of the cab and began a heated, gesticulating discussion with the scar-faced leader of the gang. In his confused and swiftly weakening condition, it took Johnny several seconds to work it out. Gomo, he thought. Gomo is one of them. He set it up. It should not have come as such a shock. Johnny knew how pervasive was the corruption in the government, in all departments, not only the Parks Administration. He had given evidence before the official commission of inquiry that was investigating the corruption, and had pledged to help stamp it out. He knew Gomo well. He was arrogant and self-seeking. He was just the type. But Johnny had never expected treachery on this scale. Suddenly the area around the godown that Johnny could see was teeming with the other members of the gang. Swiftly, Scarface organized them into a work party. One of them shot the lock off the door of the warehouse, and the bandits laid aside their weapons and swarmed into the building. There were shouts of greedy joy as they saw the piles of ivory, and then they formed a human chain and began passing out the tusks and loading them into the truck. Johnny's vision began to fade. Clouds of darkness passed across his eyes, and there was a soft singing in his ears. "I'm dying," he thought without emotion. He could feel the numbness spreading from his paralyzed legs up through his chest. He forced the darkness back from his eyes and thought that he must be fantasizing, for now Ambassador Ning stood in the late sunlight below the veranda. He still had the binoculars slung over his shoulder, and his manner was impossibly cool and urbane. Johnny tried to shout a warning to him, but it came out of his throat in a soft croak that did not carry beyond the room in which he lay. Then, to his astonishment, he saw the scar-faced leader of the gang come to where the ambassador stood and salute him, if not respectfully, at least with recognition of his authority. Ning. Johnny forced himself to believe it. It really is Ning. I'm not dreaming it. Then the voices of the two men carried to where he lay. They were speaking in English. "You must hurry your men," Ning Cheng Gong said. "They must get the ivory loaded. I want to leave here immediately." "Money," answered Sali. $1,000. His English was atrocious. "You have been paid," Cheng was indignant. "I have paid you your money." "More money. More $1,000. Sali grinned at him. "More money or I stop. We go. Leave you. Leave ivory." "You are a scoundrel," Cheng snarled. "Not understand scoundrel, but think you also scoundrel, maybe." Sali's grin widened. "Give money now." "I haven't got any more money with me," Cheng told him flatly. "Then we go. Now. You load ivory yourself." "Wait," Cheng was obviously thinking quickly. "I haven't got money. You take the ivory, as much as you want. Take everything you can carry." Cheng had realized that the poachers would be able to take only a negligible number of tusks from the hoard. They could not possibly manage more than a single tusk each. 20 men, 20 tusks, it was a small price. Sali stared at him while he considered the offer. Clearly he had milked every possible advantage from the situation, so at last he nodded. "Good. We take ivory." He began to turn away. Ambassador Ning called after him. "Wait, Sali! Why about others? Did you take care of them?"
"They are all dead."
"The warden and his woman and children, them too?"
"All dead," Sali repeated. "Woman is dead and her piccanins. My men make jig-jig with all three women first.
Very funny, very nice jig-jig. Then kill."
"And the warden, where is he?"
Sali the poacher jerked his head towards the door of Johnny's office. "I shoot him, boom, boom. He dead like an inglubu. Dead like a pig."
He laughed.
"Very good job, eh?"
He walked away with the rifle over his shoulder, still chuckling, and Cheng followed him out of Johnny's field of vision. Anger came to arm Johnny and give him just a little more strength. The poacher's words conjured up a dreadful vision of the fate that had overtaken Mavis and the children. He could see it as clearly as if he had been there. He knew about rape and pillage. He had lived through the Bush War. He used the strength of his anger to begin to wriggle across the floor towards his desk. He knew he could not use a weapon. All he could hope for now, in the few minutes of life that remained to him, was to leave some sort of message. Papers had spilled off his desk and littered the floor. If he could just get to a single sheet and write on it and hide it, the police would find it later. He moved like a maimed caterpillar, lying on his back, still clutching the severed artery. He drew up his good knee, dug in his heel, and pushed himself painfully across the floor, sliding on his back a few inches at a time, his own blood lubricating his passage. He moved 6 feet towards the desk and reached out for one of the sheets of paper. He saw then that it was a sheet from the wages register. He had not touched it when the intensity of the light in the room altered. Somebody was standing in the doorway. He turned his head, and Ambassador Ning was staring at him. He had come up onto the veranda. His rubber-soled training shoes made no sound at all. Now he stood petrified with shock in the doorway, and for a moment longer he stared at Johnny. Then he yelled shrilly, "He's still alive! Sally, come quickly! He's still alive!" Cheng disappeared from the doorway and ran down the veranda, still shouting for the poacher, "Sally, come quickly!" It was all over, and Johnny knew it. Only seconds remaining to him. He rolled on his side, reached out, and snatched up the register sheet. He pressed the sheet flat onto the floor with one hand, and then released the severed artery and drew his blood-drenched hand out of the front of his trousers. Immediately he felt the artery begin to pulse, and fresh blood jetted from the wound. With his forefinger he scrawled on the blank sheet of paper, writing in his own blood. He formed the letter N in a large, lopsided character, and dizziness made his senses swirl. N-I. It was more difficult to concentrate. The downstroke of the I was elongated and curved, too much like a J. Painfully he dotted the letter to make its meaning clearer. For a moment his finger was glued lightly to the paper with his sticky blood. He pulled it free. He started on the second N. It was crude and childlike. His finger would not follow the dictates of his mind. He heard the ambassador still calling for Sally, and the poacher's answering shout filled with alarm and consternation. N-I-N. Johnny began the G, but his finger wandered off at an angle, and the wet red letters wiggled and swam before his eyes like tadpoles. He heard running feet come pounding down the veranda, and Sally's voice, "I thought he was dead. I finish him good now." Johnny crumpled the sheet of paper in his left hand, the hand that was clean of blood, and he thrust his closed fist into the front of his tunic and rolled over onto his belly, with his arm trapped under him, concealing the bald note. He did not see Sally come in at the door. His face was pressed to the concrete floor. He heard the poacher's boots squeak and slip on the blood, and then the click of the safety catch on the rifle as he stood over Johnny's prostrate form. Johnny felt no fear, only a vast sense of sorrow and resignation. He thought about Mavis and the children as he felt the muzzle of the rifle touch the back of his head. He was relieved that he would not be left alone after they were gone. He was glad that he would never see what had happened to them, would never be forced to witness the signs of their agony and degradation. He was already dying before the bullet from the AK-47 tore through his skull and buried itself in the concrete under his face.
"He's shit," said Sally.
He stepped back and shouldered the rifle, a faint feather of gun smoke still drifting from the muzzle.
"A hard man to kill. He made me waste Meningi bullets. Each one 10 kwacha, too much."
Ning Cheng Gong advanced into the room.
"Are you sure that you finished the job at last?" he asked.
"His head is gone,"
Sally grunted as he picked up Johnny's keys from the desk and went to ransack the Milner safe.
"Kufa, he dead for sure."
Cheng moved closer to the corpse and stared at it with fascination. The killing had excited him. He was sexually aroused, not as much as if it had been a young girl who had died, but aroused nevertheless. The smell of blood filled the room. He loved that smell. He was so absorbed that he did not notice that he was standing in a puddle of blood until Gomo called him from below the veranda.
"All the ivory is loaded. We are ready to go."
Cheng stepped back and exclaimed with disgust as he saw the stain on the cuff of his crisply ironed blue cotton slacks.
I'm going now," he told Sally. "Burn the ivory, go down before you leave."
In the safe, Sally had found the canvas bank bag that contained the month's wages for the camp staff, and he grunted without looking up from the contents.
"I burn everything for sure."
Cheng ran down the veranda steps and climbed into the Mercedes. He signalled to Gomo and the two refrigerator trucks pulled away. The ivory was packed into the holds and then covered with the dismembered carcasses of the culled beasts. A casual inspection would not reveal the hoard, but there was nobody to stop the convoy. They were protected by the badges of the National Parks Board painted on the trucks and by the khaki uniforms and shoulder flashes of Gomo and David, the two rangers. Not even one of the frequent roadblocks was likely to delay them. The security forces were intent on catching political dissidents, not ivory runners. It had all gone as Chetty Singh had planned it. Cheng glanced at the rearview mirror of the Mercedes. The ivory godown was already ablaze. The poachers were forming up into a column for the return march. Each of them carried a large tusk from the hoard. Cheng smiled to himself. Perhaps Sali's greed would work to his advantage. If the police ever caught up with the gang, the disappearance of the ivory would be neatly explained by both the fire and the loads the poachers were carrying. At Cheng's insistence, they had left 40 tusks in the burning godown to provide traces of charred ivory for the police forensic laboratory. As Chetty Singh might have said, another dead herring. This time Cheng laughed aloud. He was elated. The success of the raid and the thrill of violence and death and blood warmed his belly and filled him with a sense of power. He felt masterful and sexually charged, and suddenly he was aware that he had a hard, throbbing erection. He determined that next time he would do the killing himself. It was quite natural to believe that there would be a next time, and many, many more times after that. Death had made Cheng feel immortal.